It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, folks, once again, it's time for another edition of Valley Edition. It's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio today Terry Snyder. Welcome, Terry.
Hi, Mike. Glad to be here.
And out there somewhere in the cold world that we call winter in Alaska, Zaz Hollander. Welcome, Zaz.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Hi, Mike and Terry.
Well, this has been an extraordinary week leading up to Christmas. Very often a time, holiday time, when people are beginning to move toward celebrations of one sort or another. Various legislative bodies tend to go home, finish up their work, etc. And of course, both on the national scene and locally, we have all kinds of activity, I put that. But before we turn to those things that have been happening, Zaz, I know you've been covering something that has, 2 years of history, and that's the Grunewald trial. Maybe you could just update us on what's happening there.
Sure. So, yeah, it has been a little over 2 years since David Grunewald was murdered, and 5 teenagers were charged, 4 of them with murder, and the first one to go before a jury was convicted in May, and now the second teenage defendant, Dominic Johnson, is in fourth week of the trial just ended, or is ending this week with the case. Both sides rested their cases yesterday, and so the next step is on Wednesday, closing statements, and then the case goes to the jury for deliberations. And this, as we've talked about on this program, is a slightly different trial. The first trial, Eric Allmendinger's trial, had a lot of information about what Allmendinger told authorities in terms of what he said happened. Whereas this trial, most of that information is not allowable, and so prosecutors are having to build their case a different way. But this past week, for the first time, there was potentially incriminating evidence of a video surfaced very recently, a video that investigators had known about for almost 2 years.
Wow.
Because they'd seen it referenced in texts from Dominic Johnson's mother, Misty, who also sent texts very strongly implying that she knew what her son did, that she had asked her now ex-boyfriend to destroy or at least take away clothes that Dominic was wearing that had blood on them. And she had text messages saying, I know what he did in that, but I want it back anyway. At any rate, she also referenced a video that, if I was on a jury and I saw that, I would convict him kind of stuff. But investigators couldn't find the video until last week, when a teenage witness referenced it, showed it to them, and then the teenager whose phone it was gave it to them. I believe that was on Monday, so 5 days ago. It's now Friday, the 21st of December. And so that on that video, it's really sure it's a Snapchat video. Usually those disappear, but you can save them. And it's Dominic Johnson talking about beating somebody on the head just to hurt him. And that was, the timestamp is 5:26 p.m. on November 13th, 2016. And David Grunewald was beaten and then shot and killed between 8:30 and 9:30 p.m. that night. David's name isn't mentioned. There's no talk of murdering anybody, but it was a pretty big deal. The biggest, bombshell in this trial. And then the only witness called by the defense was a state defense investigator who conducted an experiment, drove the same route as the defendants drove with Grunewald. And what she was trying to establish for the defense was that Dominic Johnson maybe had better cell phone service than prosecutors and their experts said he did. But it was a really... I'm trying to be unbiased here, but an unsuccessful argument. She was rattled. The prosecutor, Roman Kalachak, kind of lit into her on how it was that she could prove that just having bars on your phone means you can make phone calls on your phone. And she said, I don't know. I didn't do any research. So the only witness for the defense, I have to say, was a pretty unsuccessful one.
Wow.
We'll see what happens. The jury literally is still out.
Okay.
These trials are never over till they're over, are they?
That's right.
Yeah, and a lot of that happens, seems like that happens, as those last little bit, the pieces of evidence can be changed the whole program. The last three defendants, are they being tried together? Is it just each and every one? Does a community, I guess, David's parents, everybody have to go through this three more times?
Well, there are only two more defendants who are charged with the murder. The fifth, Devin Peterson, has already been convicted on evidence tampering and then some other federal court charges. Mm-hmm. So he's serving 9 years in prison.
Okay.
But there are two more, Austin Barrett and Bradley Renfro. And at this point, they're being tried together. I believe their attorneys are expected to file a motion to sever their cases, as well as a motion for change of venue, which both attorneys in the previous, in the Dominic Johnson and Eric Allmendinger, filed, and those motions were denied. Those motions, as far as I know, there haven't been motions to sever filed yet.
Okay. All right. Since we have you in focus, I know that you have had an opportunity to attend a meeting that few of us have, and that involves the port. Maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the Port Commission, and I have an ugly confession to make. I mean, I've covered Matthew Burrow closely since 2002, and you know, we all follow the port. I've never been to a Port Commission meeting until this past week. When I attended, the only other member of the public there was Eugene Haberman, who attends many, many public meetings in Mattsu and in Anchorage for free, and every single time comes up and is kind of a parliamentarian, and he had the same role here at the Port Commission meeting, but it was an interesting meeting. There were kind of two major subjects discussed, and one was earthquake damage. And that to the port, and there really isn't a ton of new information there. That there was a certain amount of damage at the port, the most significant to a conveyor that ran from the upland town to, or rather from resource kind of staging areas to ship the ship dock.
Right.
And the owner of that facility is not the borough; it's NPI, which is no longer doing business with the borough. And so it's incumbent on NPI to fix the conveyor. The borough had the port director or the acting port director or the port manager had reached out to NPI, and they are starting work on it. I'm very interested to see if they follow up on all the repairs that need to be done or if more legal action needs to be taken down the road. But there's no discussion of legal action at this point. And then there's other damage. The barge dock that was under millions of dollar repair, apparently that repair was pretty much wrapped up. The earthquake did not further damage the barge dock. A diver went down and had to kind of go by feel because you can't see the boat underwater, and didn't feel any additional problems with the dock. So the earthquake kind of surprisingly doesn't seem to have done significant damage to the port except for that conveyor. But the other interesting topic was the A2A rail project. And this is something that the borough has been talking about for over a year, but only surfaced at assembly recently. And so this is a giant multi-billion dollar project that would run rail from Alberta to Alaska to export bitumen, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, and the kind of the deal for the borough would be apparently the A2A backers are offering to pay the rest of the cost for the Port McKenzie rail extension.
Wow.
Which is, I think, about $125 million, and that's the unfinished rail line from the Parks Highway to the port that is kind of hailed as the really only way to get our port up and running again. But the issue is if A2A pays for that extension to be finished, they would operate that section of the line. And that needs to be approved by the Alaska Railroad.
Own it or just be the operator on it?
They would operate it. I don't know if it would be a lease arrangement. I'm not sure how the, what exactly the paperwork would say.
But I'm thinking of the map. I'm looking at the map and I'm saying I know where this gap is. It's a relatively short gap, even though it's $125 million. But what about the rest of the story? The line that goes
from the gap
into Canada. I mean, that's got to be a massive operation.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is it feels a little like another borough white elephant, but we'll see. We'll see where it goes from here. It's a giant project, even without this little, you know, kind of drop in the bucket section in terms of funding for the rest of the rail extension.
So are they waiting for any decision? Are they just wanting the Port Commission to be aware and weigh in?
It was an update for the commission, and the borough manager provided the update, and he did say that at this point, I don't have anything close enough to bring to the assembly. Mm-hmm. There had been talk of the assembly, I think, even signing off on this arrangement very soon, and it doesn't sound like negotiations are anywhere close to the point where the assembly would want to sign off on something.
Is that, I'm thinking about the big timber sale that was supposed to happen that kind of fell through, that was a big ruckus for a while. That's kind of gone now too, right?
And that apparently now is officially gone.
Okay.
That, the borough has let them out of their lease.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, as the lease, speaking of a lease, I'm curious about the conveyor, MPI conveyor. Is that part of their leasehold agreement to keep that in good working order? I mean, how is
they have to maintain it because they own it, mm-hmm. and the borough can't move resources at the port without that conveyor.
Ah.
Okay. Well, speaking about another large project, I am aware that there has been a recent flurry of activity and discussion about Pebble Mine. We've had the former president of the University of Alaska, Mark Hamilton, speak at a local Rotary Club meeting, and he is apparently working, representing the Pebble Consortium in some fashion. And there were also pieces in the paper, as well as one would say, and some of those changes happening in Juneau, particularly the placement of certain of the commissioners and other people that would have a role to play in overseeing or approving or dealing with the Pebble Mine expansion that seemed to be identified as more favorable in one sense or another, as well as the governor himself.
The governor hasn't really said. I mean, he was questioned on that all during the campaign. And whereas Mr. Begich said right out that he was not for the Pebble Mine, Mr. Dunleavy wouldn't take a stand at that
Fair
point.
Fair enough. So the implication is that he might be more favorable than Senator Begich, certainly, in that regard. Well, let's just finish up with looking at a couple of the meetings that happened here recently. We shared those meeting duties. Terry went to one, and I went to the other.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say the takeaway from the assembly would be, the most significant meeting result as you're thinking about what happened there?
I guess two things kind of sticks out without looking in my notes, Mike, and that is that they passed the small racetrack ordinance that they've been dutifully working on for a long time with a group of users who seemed to really work together, even though they had to make compromises on both sides. So that was unfinished business that went pretty smoothly, and there were only a couple speakers. Unlike most times when the place is filled up, they made note of the fact that they had told people to stand down, that they thought they had a workable solution here. And so that went through pretty easily. There were two vetoes on the agenda having to do with future meetings, one about wetlands, the Barrett mayor's veto in having that conversation was upheld, and then one on air quality. I think I've got this right, that they are going to go ahead and have in January, even though that particular thing has been kicked down to the Planning Commission, who has kicked it on until February. They are going to host, I think, January 22nd, a session on it, so they won't take any action. But just to get an update from all the DECs, whoever they invite to the meeting, so that they can get some of the accurate information out there. There's been a lot of miscommunication, I think, on this particular topic. And I guess the last thing is to say that I thought that Terry Dolan did a really good job from Public Works reporting on what the big struggle was on opening the dump or the landfill for a few days so that people could get rid of their earthquake materials. And he was asked for, when they passed that, letting that open up for 5 days, the task with accounting for how much in revenue that cost the borough. And he came back with numbers, hard numbers, or he thinks they are, in wages and what it costs. About $67,000 is his estimate, most of it coming in from this area, from the central landfill, and the rest of it around the borough, but mostly from the Big Lake area, about 30% of it. And he did say, which kind of surprised me, that they felt that FEMA would probably reimburse those funds as part of the FEMA thing, which is an ongoing thing. So I guess those are the most prevalent things that came out of that meeting, Mike.
Okay. But over at the school board the next day on Wednesday, there were a number of, I think, significant things that happened. One was that board member Ruth's last meeting occurred. She is from the Big Lake area, yeah. And she is going off to take another opportunity, which takes her out of the region and out of her seat. So there will be an appointment for that seat, and one person on the school board could make a big difference. I have not yet heard of who is going to be applying. That'll be an appointment, I believe, that will go until the next election, when it will be coming up again. The second thing that happened was that Pioneer Peak was recognized recently as one of the 300 schools in the nation to be tagged as a Blue Ribbon School. And Mary Watts, the principal there, did a presentation. This is a significant honor when you start thinking about 300 schools in this fashion. And she did a presentation as well to the school board. There was a bit of a discussion about the CIP list. And for those listeners who don't know what CIP means, it really has to do with the wish list that a body would have, whether it's the assembly or the school board, about things to ask for, really, that are more capital intensive. And there was some discussion, interestingly enough, about the items on the list in terms of their receptivity. I think we've seen the first examples of bodies locally that are looking toward Juneau and saying, I wonder what's going to happen there. And are there some new personalities at play that would change reception for requests for one thing or another? I think it's safe to say that, Terry.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. It's going to be wait and see. There's been a lot of promises made on the campaign trail, and a lot of new administration to deal with, new staff, new legislators. I think that is kind of a wait and see. I know the borough is going to have a meeting with them January 3rd in the LIO office, a formal informal meeting with them. They'll have lots of them. They have their lobbyist, John Harris, on it, apparently, working out some issues that might lie ahead. And I'm sure that the school district also has a lobbyist that they're going to be leaning on, because it's going to be more important than ever to day to day to find out what's going on down there.
And the dominoes keep falling. I can only think of it in that way. For example, most recently, a lady in Eagle River, Gretchen Wemhoff, who had run for the Alaska State House a couple of times, was recently selected by the assembly.
Out of several candidates.
Out of 11 candidates, mm-hmm. To replace Domboski, who had been asked to become a deputy chief of staff in the governor's office. What's interesting about that is it is, I think, safe to say that Domboski was referred to as a conservative member of the assembly body. And her replacement is not. She is of a different party, but is also arguably either more moderate or liberal, how you would like to place it. But it fell to the assembly to choose her for an appointment. And at the present time, it turns out that the Anchorage Assembly leans a little bit to a more liberal direction. So it was obvious that they would choose somebody who might fit that
right
mold.
And it's a really very short-term appointment. She will have to run for her seat in April.
Right.
So I think this is kind of a kickstart on that. She's been very involved locally and state-wise, and run for office a couple times, so the campaigning is not new to her. That probably was an advantage to that. But, you know, I think she's definitely more moderate than Ms. Domboski, but she's as a school teacher and has a lot of knowledge on that, but you know, about local politics too. So,
okay,
good luck to her.
So one of the things I'd like to finish up with, perhaps, is since it seems to be an event that keeps on giving, is the earthquake itself. Zaz, how's your water?
Yeah, we have to have a water report, Zaz.
It's better. Still a little bit cloudy. Still working on the leaking filter. Probably got shot by sediment. Mm-hmm. But a bigger concern for way more people is the condition of river and lake ice.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
After the quake, we're all following, and I think by the time this program airs, we'll probably know more about the couple from Anchorage who were snow machining on Big Lake and were last seen over the weekend and haven't been seen since. But there is a very large area of thin ice on Big Lake, and they were on Big Lake on Sunday. And so it just goes out as a word of warning to people who are out on the ice. The borough is now saying stay off lake and river ice in the borough, because you can't be sure, especially with snow cover on top of it, how thick it is.
Yeah.
And after the earthquake, things changed.
Yeah, a couple of things about that. I have a house on Big Lake, and I've watched that lake freeze many, many times. And it's always a problem on the west end because there's a lot of, and all over, we have springs throughout that lake, and there's a wind that comes across, and it's the last part to freeze down there. And if you get just a little bit of snow like we did after a thin case of ice, and we didn't have a lot of ice on that end, particularly before the earthquake, it can be a very big problem, and that's why you're not seeing any roads plowed. I think that the people of Big Lake those that live there and know have done as much as they possibly can to let the public know how unsafe and unsturdy the ice has been, particularly after the earthquake. But, you know, some people don't, you know, they see a nice open space, and that's sort of a luxury to be up there and be the only one out on the ice. And, you know, it's a sad thing when it doesn't turn out the way you hoped it to. And there's not a lot of year-round residents in those areas. There's not road around that lake. People kind of think you can just drive around the lake. You can't. The roads end very close, not, you know, at the west end, sort of. There's more roads than there used to be, but there is a lot, mine included, a piece of property that doesn't have road access. So people need to be knowledgeable in anywhere they go in Alaska, but we tend to get a little, maybe a little sloppier when we're in sort of the urban areas and think that it's not as important as being out there in the trails. And it's very, very important to know where you're walking, riding, ice skating, whatever it is, because I know I've had my property almost 30 years out there, and there's been an incredible amount of close calls, hopefully this one won't end that way, but it's not looking real good.
Okay, and as we come toward the end of 2018, people are looking toward Juneau for a variety of things, but one is to see what the number will be for the permanent fund dividend checks this year. That's still considered and is often referenced as a boost to the Alaska economy, particularly as a one shot in the fall. But the suggestion that it will be $3,000 seems to be the reference point. The idea that it would be more than that, up to $6,000 or more, is considered to be less likely. And all of this is swirling around promises made by the new governor to restore the dividend, to increase it to a higher value than might have been before, while faced with something that there is very little that Alaska can control, and that is the price of oil, which continues to decline a bit, making those people heading toward Juneau looking to have a much more difficult job with the budget this year. And
oh, yeah, I think it's going to be a struggle. Again, campaign promises, hard to keep sometimes. Easy to say, hard to keep.
Got it. Well, I want to thank Zaz Hollander for calling in today and sharing. You carried the ball for the good part of the first portion of the show. Thank you for doing that.
Oh, sure thing. And Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to everybody.
Yeah, right. Hope you get some well-deserved rest during the holidays.
And
but the news doesn't seem to stop during the holiday, so that's unfortunate.
And Terry, thank you for coming into the studio today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Valley Edition.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Matsu Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.